The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Day one of a new reality for Afghanistan. For one women's rights advocate, this is how she sees things right now.
Oh, this is so sad. I think my country will go back 50 years.
I'm Marco Werman. Today on the show, we look back at how we got here.
It's time for American troops to come home.
But after 20 years of war, there was a rush for the exits. And Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is taking a page out of the Trump playbook, making baseless claims to sow seeds of doubt ahead of next year's elections, even using some of the same messengers like Steve Bannon.
Bolsonaro will win unless it's stolen by, guess what? The machines.
The machines.
Those stories and a piece of good news on the environmental front coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. After 20 years, America's war in Afghanistan is now officially ended. In a speech at the White House this afternoon, President Joe Biden thanked U.S. service members who helped evacuate some 124,000 people from Kabul.
For weeks, they risked their lives to get American citizens, Afghans who helped us, citizens of our allies and partners and others on board planes and out of the country.
Biden defended his choice to end the evacuation of Kabul today, August 31st, painting his administration as bound by promises made by the Trump administration in an agreement with the Taliban.
We faced one of two choices. Follow the agreement of the previous administration and extend it to have or extend to have more time for people to get out. Or send in thousands of more troops.
Biden said more than 5,500 Americans were evacuated from Afghanistan, but up to 200 may still remain. There is no deadline for their departure, he said. He also defended the way the rushed evacuation played out.
Imagine if we'd begun evacuations in June or July, bringing in thousands of American troops and evacuating more than 120,000 people in the middle of a civil war. There still would have been a rush to the airport, a breakdown in confidence and control of the government, and it still would have been a very difficult and dangerous mission.
He ended the speech saying, "I believe this is the right decision, a wise decision, and the best decision for America." We'll hear more about how Afghans are looking ahead to their future after the Taliban takeover. First, though, The World's Matthew Bell looks back to the last several weeks and how we got to today.
The United States has been leaving Afghanistan for years, but the end of this long war seems to have taken a lot of people by surprise. Way back in his first term, Barack Obama vowed to end the war in Afghanistan. He sent more troops, but at the same time set a departure date of 2014. That year came and went. When Donald Trump was elected, he looked for a way out. His administration sat down with the Taliban and signed a deal to remove American forces by May of this year. That's the deal President Biden said he would abide by. And in April, he set a new departure date, September 11th, 2021.
I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
As the American military stepped up the pace of its withdrawal, U.S. officials talked about Afghan government forces holding on for 6 months at least, but the Taliban was on the march. In early July, Biden was asked by a reporter,
"Is a Taliban takeover of Afghanistan now inevitable?"
"No, it is not. Because you have the Afghan troops have 300,000 well equipped as any army in the world, and an air force, against something like 75,000 Taliban. It is not inevitable."
But by then, the Taliban was taking over large parts of the countryside, major highways, and beginning to threaten major cities. The World's Shirin Jafari was in Afghanistan during the last week of July.
So we are on one of the main highways that lead out of Kabul, the capital.
and 10 minutes drive from here is Taliban territory. This is how close the Taliban are to the capital.
By August 1st, it was difficult to find an accurate online map of Afghanistan showing areas still held by the government because Afghan troops were laying down their weapons seemingly as fast as Taliban forces could advance. During the first 2 weeks of August, one city after another fell to the Taliban. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby acknowledged that the situation was deteriorating, but as late as August 11th, he said no one should assume that Kabul would fall.
It really depends on the kind of political and military leadership that the Afghans can muster to turn this around. They have the capability, they have the capacity, and now it's really time to use those things.
4 days later, President Ashraf Ghani fled the country and the Taliban seized control of the Afghan capital.
Smiling and victorious, they took this city of 6 million people in a matter of hours.
Clarissa Ward was there reporting for CNN.
This is a sight I honestly thought I would never see. Scores of Taliban fighters and just behind us, the U.S. Embassy compound.
That was just 2 weeks ago. Since then, much of the world's attention focused on the Kabul airport. American and other international personnel rushed to get flights out of the country, along with tens of thousands of Afghans. Crowds of desperate people gathered outside the gates of the airport as Taliban militiamen, in coordination with American troops, posted security. Last Thursday, a suicide attack there killed some 200 Afghans and 13 U.S. service members. And around midnight last night, the last U.S. troops flew out of Kabul. Today, the Taliban took control of Hamid Karzai International Airport, with a top official telling the Associated Press on the tarmac that Afghanistan is finally free. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
On this first day of full Taliban rule in Afghanistan, many vulnerable Afghans are hiding out at home. They're scared to venture out into the streets. That's the case for our next guest. He's worked in intelligence with a U.S. Army unit and later as a journalist. For security reasons, we're not using his name. We're also masking his voice. We've heard many different sorts of reactions from Afghans to the news that the last U.S. plane had departed from Kabul International Airport. How do you feel hearing that news?
It is very disappointing. And on the other hand, if we just look at how irresponsible the U.S. government left Afghanistan in one of its largest battles in the military history, it is pretty much shameful for Afghans to have this sort of a weak connection with the United States, to not have them properly convinced to at least withdraw from the country more responsibility and less chaotic than what had happened.
When you say it's shameful for Afghans, explain what you mean.
Because our leaders, the Afghan government people and the elders, they did not develop a sort of relationship as good as it was required with the U.S. to convince them to withdraw as they should have.
Today, with the U.S. pullout complete, what is your own situation? How safe do you feel?
I don't feel safe anywhere, even a single percent, because when the Taliban took over, we saw that within 2 hours, the Taliban fighters were running down the block where we were living. And when it became dark, we decided we change clothes, change appearance, and we leave to another place. Since that first day, we changed our safe house 5 times. I don't feel safe at all, especially working for a U.S. government agency and a place that the Taliban previously, over the last 5 years, 10 years, they always labeled us as American spies, even though we are non-military. I don't feel safe at all. I believe that it is going to get extremely, extremely dangerous compared to what it already is for everybody like me in the coming weeks.
And do you still have papers, documents, or affidavits that you worked for the U.S.?
I have everything. I mean, from my first employment back in 2006 with the U.S. government, a civilian agency, and then with the United States military, several branches of them, I have every single piece of paper. And I emailed our documents and appealed for evacuation to 158 email addresses of various governments and agencies.
You're moving, as you said, from house to house. How long can you keep doing that?
The 5 times that I left and changed safe houses, it was because I was looked for, my identity was asked, where I lied to them. I have so far introduced myself as a carpenter to the Taliban, as a mechanic, and as a doctor on the 3 occasions that they asked for my occupation. And the 2 other occasions, once I got myself hidden in an elevator shaft, and the second time I just saw them walking up the block, I left to the neighbor's house.
Wow. You said when the Taliban overthrew Kabul a few weeks ago, you changed, your family changed their clothes and moved that first time to another corner of the city. What did you change into? I mean, how are you staying disguised?
Right now, it's a local headwear. It's a large scarf. There are no fancy shoes. It's just the sandals. And it's been 3 weeks that I have not trimmed my beard. And when I look at myself, I sometimes don't recognize myself with what I used to look like.
Have you been out on the streets of Kabul today?
I have not been out since 11 days.
What are you most worried about?
Changing safe houses. I'm worried that at one stage I might not find anywhere else to go. I mean, eventually your relatives, they get fed up and they will tell you, please don't come here anymore because you pose a security risk.
Can you tell us about anything else going on in Kabul? Are banks and cafes open? I mean, any semblance of life as you remember it?
Cafes, restaurants, hotels, most of them are closed down, and the few that are open, there are no customers just like we used to see before. You don't see any girls in jeans and trousers roaming around with, you know, a sharp red lipstick or a short scarf, nail polish on their hands. And you don't get to see any woman's face. There's no cash in the market. ATMs are out of service. You know, people who didn't withdraw cash before the Taliban took over, they're asking every single friend and family relative. The wire services are also down. Nobody can send you money from outside or other provinces. And it's a total chaos. Government is non-functional. If you have a complaint, if you have a security concern, there's nobody you can go to.
I know you tried to get to the airport during the evacuation, but you were not able to get inside. So what are your options now?
Right now, I'm just waiting to see if I could get a couple of visas for either the neighboring countries, southeast or up north. I spent 3 nights at the airport gate. I went there 3 times. The only time that I could even speak to a U.S. Marine was when I had to cross the trench. It's covered with barbed wire and basically a sewer with dirty water running in it. And I get to speak to a U.S. Marine. And he said, okay, you can come up. I just gave him the name of the U.S. Army unit that I served with. But at that point, when I told him that I have to go get my family, the Marine said, it's either going to be you or nobody because I can't have you wait in the trench and I can't wait for you to go take your family from thousands of people's midst and come back. So it's either going to be you or none of you. And I said, well, I can't leave my without my family because they don't have anybody else. And I just had to go home. And just 3 hours after I left, the multiple explosions happened at the airport. And I was sort of grateful that I left earlier and didn't wait to try my chance again.
Wow, what a story. What a dilemma. Our guest in Kabul did not feel comfortable using his name due to security concerns. As you heard, we've also masked his voice. Thank you very much for your time. Stay safe.
My pleasure.
Later this hour, our coverage of Afghanistan continues as we hear about the unique fear among women there now. Coming first, a major environmental success story. Remember leaded gasoline? You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you're of a certain age, you might remember going to a gas station and having the choice between leaded or unleaded gasoline. Decades ago, leaded gas was billed as something that would improve engine performance. But by the 1970s, the known health risks of lead exposure led to the slow phase-out in the U.S. and other developed countries of leaded gasoline. Now the U.N. has declared the official end of leaded gas in passenger cars everywhere on the planet. The last of it was used in Algeria in July. Rob DeYoung with the United Nations headed up a 20-year global campaign to phase out leaded gas worldwide. So, Rob, how big of a deal is it that leaded gas for passenger cars is no longer available anywhere on Earth?
For us, it's a very big deal. The estimates are that this prevents more than 1.2 million premature deaths per year. It was the biggest pollutant. But what is almost as important is the notion, and that came in the 60s and 70s, that when children are growing up in an environment where leaded petrol is used, i.e. they breathe lead and the lead goes in their lungs and straight into their blood, it was harming their mental development. It was harming the growth of their brains. Myself, having grown up in a city where leaded petrol was used, I probably have lost between 5 and 10 IQ points. And this is quite a bit. This is measurable in performance at school.
Briefly, what was the rationale for having lead in gasoline in the first place?
Well, in the 1920s, they discovered if you add lead to petrol, it increases the octane. And what that means is it improves the combustion of the fuel in the engine. But that lead that you add is not combusted. So it goes out of the exhaust together with the other exhaust emissions. And that way, we were starting to spread lead all over our atmosphere where cars were driving and, of course, where humans are living, like in the city center.
So why did the UN have to step in and take on leaded gas in 2002?
So in the 70s and 80s, most developed countries had phased it out, like in the US and then Europe. But then it sort of stopped a bit. And many developing countries were not aware of the health issues related to the use of leaded gasoline. And that's where the UN stepped in and said, can we work together, oil industry, government, civil society, to get rid of this? 2002, 117 countries were still using leaded petrol. So that's the majority of the world.
Right. And so why was it hard to phase out leaded gas in those countries?
Well, these people have been driving around cars using leaded petrol for 80 years. And then this new product comes on the market, which, by the way, is also more expensive. So, of course, drivers were skeptical. And we had to educate them and explain to them why this is better. At the same time, there were these rumors going around that unleaded petrol was only for new cars. It was a product coming from the West, and you need to have a new car to drive it. Well, it's actually not true. In addition to that, there was, of course, resistance to the local oil industry. So it was quite a difficult campaign.
So Algeria was the last country, as I said, to be selling leaded gas. Why was Algeria the last?
Well, actually, when we started in 2002, I think I mentioned to you there were 117 countries left. Mm. In 10 years after that, there were only six left. And then we took another 10 years to have those six also to go to unleaded. And of course, it's always the hardest cases that remain to last. It's Yemen, it's Iraq, it's Afghanistan, it's North Korea, it's Algeria. Those were the countries remaining. And you can imagine it wasn't easy for us to work with these countries. There were either in war and conflict. And some of these countries also, the one remaining supplier of the lead compound, they went to these countries, bribed some government officials, and they bought huge stockpiles of the lead additive. Mm. I can tell you that because the company was convicted in a court of law in the United States and in the United Kingdom for doing this in Iraq and Indonesia. And so the last countries also had built up those stockpiles, had to finish them. And that's why it took a bit longer for the very last ones to join the rest.
Rob DeYoung headed up the UN's nearly 20-year global campaign to phase out leaded gasoline worldwide. He's head of sustainable mobility at the United Nations Environment Program. He's been speaking with us from Nairobi. Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you, and have a great day.
2020 was a tough year for nearly every consumer industry. Cookbooks, though, are one of the few exceptions. With lots of time spent in lockdown and kitchens, cookbook sales have soared around the globe. Market analysts tracked a 145% increase just in bread cookbook sales alone. You could say that's a lot of dough, and I did. Now, one chef in the UK is helping folks cook without the book. The world's Bianca Hillier happily took on this assignment.
This is what I call a great day at work. I'm not at my desk, I'm in my kitchen, wrapping an apron around my waist, clearing my counter, and preheating my oven to 350 degrees. But instead of pulling out a cookbook or a laptop to guide me through a cake recipe, I pop in my headphones and press play on my phone.
I'll run through the process in detail soon, But first, let's check that you've got the ingredients you're going to need. Open the Notes app on your phone or pause while you go get a pen and paper to write this down.
Ruby Tando fills my ears. She doesn't consider herself a professional chef, but she's humble. Tando has written 3 cookbooks, with another on the way, and was a finalist on that Great British Baking Show you may have heard of. Now she's helping home cooks like me through an audio guide called Breaking Eggs.
I'm not trying to teach people how to make the best ever, like, wedding cake with 8 tiers or something like that. It's not that kind of baking. That's not the deal here. It's just about enjoying the process. I just think it's so vital.
Your sour cream and eggs should be ready.
The audio cookbook, possibly the first of its kind, has 4 simple recipes. Today, I'm making the easy butter cake. In real time, Tando walks me through the recipe.
What you've got to do now is combine and cream the butter and sugar mixture, beating it until fluffy.
Okay.
Get started now. It's going to take about 5 minutes by hand or slightly less time with an electric mixer.
Okay. My hand mixer largely covers up Tando's voice, but as I mix, she fills the time by explaining what I should be seeing, smelling, and importantly, feeling.
You might notice as you bake your appetite waking up and your breathing slow or quicken. Your heartbeat leaping when you drop an egg, or your mouth begin to water when you crack open the vanilla.
Under Tando's gentle counsel, I notice aspects of the process I've never previously observed during my own countless quarantine baking sessions. As I fold in the flour, it feels like Tando is in the kitchen with me.
If you've been mixing while I've been talking, it should be ready by now.
Almost like we're friends. Tando says that's by design.
The hope was that it would feel a little bit like if you had someone with you in the kitchen. Just whoever, just someone kind of perched on the work surface near you, kind of talking you through it if you weren't really sure what you were doing. And they're just there for the whole experience.
The experience requires trust that Tando won't move on to the next step too quickly. And it's more intimate than a traditional cookbook. Tando finds this new audio format both exciting and accessible for a new audience.
Obviously, I read a lot of cookbooks. I enjoy cookbooks, but I realize that these are huge books. They're heavy, they're expensive, there are a lot of words in them. For so many different people, they're not accessible, whether that's the price, whether it's because you just don't take in information that way. There's a million reasons why you might not like them.
Tando's guide isn't the first to break from cookbook tradition. Cooking videos on TikTok, for example, have redefined the genre. But Breaking Eggs is proof that audio guides have real value in the kitchen.
Mm. Wow.
I ended up with a golden, buttery cake and an hour of joyful, stress-free baking, which Tando says is just what the recipe calls for. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
More stories from around the globe coming up. You're listening to The World.
Okay, people, so this is basically the main market of the city.
A walking tour of Cartagena, Colombia, with a new focus on Black history.
So most of the Afro-Colombian population will be working here, trying to make a living every day, grinding, you know what I mean?
We're also headed to the Mexico-Guatemala border, where immigration policy gets personal. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The U.S. is out of Afghanistan, but the chaotic last few days of the mission there left many Afghans stranded, people who had worked with the international community and who now fear reprisal by the Taliban. Yesterday, I spoke with one Afghan woman in Kabul who was coming to terms with the reality that she would not get out. We are not using her name to protect her identity. She had received a message over the weekend that said, "We regret to inform you that international military evacuations from Kabul airport have ended." That message was a gut punch. After years of working on high-profile women's empowerment projects, she would not be able to get out of Afghanistan on the last departing flights.
There was different outreach to us. Please prepare this form and that form and send this document and that document. But at the end of the day, no result. I applied for many country visas. I worked for Canadian, I worked for French, and I worked for USAID main office in the U.S. Embassy, but no one came back to me for the flight. And I know many women who are women rights activists. they're still in the country and they are struggling for the situation that may happen to them in the coming weeks and coming days.
And you submitted the documents to those embassies in order for evacuation, but you did not hear back from any of them?
Yeah. All these countries, they announced internationally that they are supporting women rights activists. And while I'm now currently leading a big women economic empowerment rural development program, that is $100 million funded World Bank project implemented through government of Afghanistan through Ministry of Women Affairs.
What are you and your family's options now, if any, for getting out of Afghanistan?
I think to go to the third country, preferably the neighboring country. I keep trying and I'm still thinking positive for this option. This is like plan B for me.
So I'm wondering what sort of future women who've been vocal and upfront about women's issues, what kind of future do you face if you can't get those visas?
Oh, this is so sad when I'm thinking about the future. I couldn't think about my kids, my son, my daughter. I think my country will go back 50 years when women are not allowed to go to work, when girls are not allowed to continue their education, we are not allowed to go out of home. So what remains to us? We are human beings and we like freedom for myself and for my daughter and for my son, because they have big, big dreams for their future. I have big dreams for their future.
Your daughter is entering 12th grade. What is she telling you?
Today she was crying. Actually, today it was her birthday. I totally forgot about my son went and brought a small cake for her. And we celebrated so quietly, like no one was happy, no one joked, and it was so sad. But I told her, you will have chance to continue your education.
What about your son? I gather he's at Kabul University. Will he continue his education?
Yeah, my son is so clever. Like he is A+ student in the university. He went to university one day, but the university system all collapsed because the university lecturer left Afghanistan.
Well, I hear that a mullah has been appointed the education minister under the Taliban. Are there signs already of a worsening situation for women in education?
They put a mullah as a minister of higher education. I was listening to his speech, and he was talking about separating girl students from boy students and male-female separate classes in the university. My question is, how this guy pretend that he can make this situation, because he has not allowed a woman lecturer to come to university? So what the hell is this? This is totally will eliminate women and girl students from the university. And obviously, this is their policy to take aside the women's girl students from the university. This is totally frustrating.
What do you see when you turn on the television in Afghanistan these days?
Oh, this is all dialogue with the Taliban. They talk about their policies. People should not be afraid of us. We are human and we are your brothers and blah, blah, blah. But as long as all people know, they did lots of wild action against Afghan army, against many families that were under their coverage area. Also, the 20 past year, their attitude toward the women, toward the young generation, this is life history. Many people were alive that time, and now they are seeing these people back on board. People cannot forget their attitude against women, and we are so much afraid of them.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. Stay safe.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
I was speaking there with a Kabul resident who works with an internationally funded women's project. For security reasons, we did not use her name. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is now complete, but the story continues. Explore more of our ongoing reporting on Afghanistan, including stories from the world's Shirin Jafari, who recently returned from reporting in Afghanistan. Read her recent story about how the Taliban takeover is impacting women's shelters. That's at theworld.org. Authorities in Mexico have been increasingly ejecting migrants passing through their country on their way to the United States. Every day, Mexican immigration officials have been busing hundreds of people south to a rural border crossing connecting Guatemala and Mexico. Once they're dropped off over the border, most people are lost and don't have any food. So one neighbor has taken it upon herself to wake up early every morning and make breakfast for the new arrivals. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia brings us her story.
Estrella Lopez is browning red onion slices in a large pot over the wood-fired stove in her kitchen. She slices 6 pounds of tomatoes. She cracks 90 eggs into bowls. She pours everything into the pot and sprinkles in some chicken soup seasoning along with red meat seasoning. Estrella's one-year-old son is trying to get the attention of her husband. It's 6 a.m. and the family has already been awake for hours. Estrella and her husband carry the eggs, a pot of black beans, and a large pot of black coffee down the hill from their house. And they serve it on styrofoam plates and cups to people staying at a shelter.
Sí, lo hacemos con todo nuestro corazón.
We're doing this from the heart, López says. López has been rising early to make breakfast every day for the past month. That's how long human rights organizations say Mexican authorities have been dumping busloads of Central American migrants here in the town of El Cebo, a small dot on the Mexico-Guatemala line. López and her husband sometimes pay for the groceries themselves. Others, they get help from a local health nonprofit. I feel very grateful for people who feed us, says Ezequiel Tercero, an electrician from Nicaragua who was hoping to reach the U.S. Migrants often receive the opposite of help. Mexican immigration agents were recorded in southern Mexico this weekend throwing a migrant to the ground and kicking him in the face. Authorities suspended 2 agents. But most of the 24 people I interviewed in El Cebo said they were extorted by authorities in Mexico or Guatemala. Tercero says that once people don't have any money, they walk for days without eating. He says he went 4 days getting by on what he'd find growing on trees along the way, like nance fruit, avocados, or guavas. And he says that when someone does give him a hot meal, it's difficult to enjoy it.
¿Por qué? Mi situación es trabajar.
Why, Tercero asks? He says it's because he wants to be working and paying for his own food and sending money to his family. Antonio Portillo says he migrated from Honduras before he was pushed back by U.S. Border Patrol agents near McAllen, Texas.
Sí, claro. Pasé hambre. Pasé hambre.
Portillo says that, of course, he went hungry for days, too. And he says the people who helped him along the way were people as poor as he is.
Es que sabe cuál es el problema. Que como nosotros los pobres conocemos las necesidades del pobre, si podemos ayudar a una persona...
Portillo says that poor people understand another poor man's problems. So if they can give someone a plate of food, they do. Estrella López has indeed gone through the same experience as the people she's feeding every morning.
Sí. Una vez también lo intenté yo.
López says she tried migrating to the U.S. once, about 15 years ago. She says she was a teenager and her family was desperately poor, so she wanted to move to Maryland, where she had a friend and hoped to find work.
Aguanté como 3 días. Aguanté.
López says at one point she went 3 days without food. She was walking and catching bus rides through Mexico until she was caught near Mexico City and deported. She's now a community health worker here in El Cebo, still making a very modest living. And she says seeing people go through town reminds her of her most difficult days.
Cada vez que hago esto, me siento feliz, me siento contenta, ¿me entiendes? Sumamente.
Every time I make these breakfasts, López says, I feel happy. She says it brings her joy to know that when people get back on their way, they're leaving with sustenance in their stomach. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia, El Cebo, Guatemala.
Re-election, arrest, or death? One of those is what Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro says are in his future ahead of fall's presidential election there. Bolsonaro has been following Donald Trump's lead and is already denouncing the country's upcoming vote with claims of fraud. That is raising concerns for Brazil's young democracy, barely 35 years old. Michael Fox has the story.
Brazil's voting system is seen as a model abroad.
Elections are organized at the national level and overseen by an electoral court. The country has been using electronic voting machines since 1996. Results are often reported within hours. But Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro says it's rife with fraud.
Não estou acusando os servidores do TSE. São meia dúzia.
There are a handful of members of the electoral court, and they maneuver all of this, he said during one of numerous public statements in late July. There have been complaints of fraud since 2008, he said. We can't continue to let this happen. Bolsonaro hasn't shown any evidence. Political scientist Cynthia Pinheiro Ribeiro de Souza says his claims are baseless.
Esse é sistema que em mais de 20 anos de uso se mostrou seguro e eficaz.
She says Brazil's electronic voting system has been in place for more than 20 years. It's won awards, it's proven to be secure and efficient, and we have never had any evidence of fraud or any sign of anything that would invalidate the electoral system, she says. That hasn't stopped Bolsonaro from continuing to raise the alarm. His supporters have protested in support of paper ballots. Bolsonaro has said there would be no election next year without them. 2 weeks ago, Donald Trump's former top strategic advisor Steve Bannon backed Bolsonaro and his claims of fraud at an event in the United States.
This election is the second most important election in the world, right? In the most important elections ever in South America. Bolsonaro will win unless it's stolen by, guess what? The machines.
The machines.
Bolsonaro and his family have a relatively tight relationship with Bannon, Trump, and the U.S. far right. Sociology professor Marcelo Kunrath says Trump's attacks on the results of the 2020 U.S. election helped to inspire Bolsonaro's rhetoric. He says the claims of fraud, just like they were used by Trump in the United States, are seen as a way for Bolsonaro and his allies to weaken the 2022 electoral process and find a way to legitimize a break with the democratic order. But there has been pushback from Brazilian institutions. The electoral court is now investigating Bolsonaro for spreading misinformation about the electoral system. Earlier this month, Congress rejected a Bolsonaro-backed proposal to mandate paper ballots in next year's presidential election. Kunrath says the congressional vote could be seen as a defeat for Bolsonaro.
Mas, ao mesmo tempo, o interesse dele não era propriamente a questão do voto impresso, mas a questão de colocar...
But, he says, at the same time, Bolsonaro's interest wasn't the paper vote, but rather eroding confidence in the electronic vote. It's an argument he's already prepared for an eventual defeat in 2022, Kunrath says. At this point, such a defeat seems almost inevitable. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is leading all early polls. He's 16 points ahead of Bolsonaro, whose presidency has been rocked by his mishandling of the pandemic, financial crisis, inflation, and rising unemployment. Bolsonaro's dropping popularity hasn't stopped him from lashing out at the Supreme Court and other branches of government, which he says are enemies of his administration. He also has big plans for Brazil's Independence Day on September 7th. He's called for his supporters to hit the streets, including military and police officers. Everyone has to buy a gun. The armed people will never be enslaved, he told a group of supporters last week. The idiot is the guy who wants to buy beans instead of guns, he said. Many analysts are concerned Bolsonaro may be setting the scene for a January 6th-style attempted coup, invoking violence in order to justify a military clampdown across the country. Some groups of military police have announced they will be participating on September 7th. Others say they will follow Bolsonaro's direction. Political scientist Anaís Medeiros Passos says it's unclear how much support there really is in the military for a coup-like scenario.
Existe oposição, existem oficiais democratas, né, que não se colocam.
She says, not all of the members of the armed forces are Bolsonaristas. There is opposition, but the military institutions are controlled by officials who are solidly in Bolsonaro's camp, she says. But for Medeiros Passos, one thing is for sure. This is an unprecedented moment, she says. There is a lot of political polarization. The democratic rules are under threat. We haven't seen anything like this since the end of the dictatorship, she says. All eyes are on September 7th, where the country will get a sense of exactly how much support Bolsonaro has in the streets and in the military, and what we might expect in the lead-up to next year's elections. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
In Colombia this summer, protesters are taking down statues of Spanish conquistadors like Christopher Columbus, pulled to the ground with a rope in the city of Barranquilla. Columbus, of course, is the man for whom the country was named. Much like here in the U.S., a debate has emerged in Colombia over the legacy of these historic figures. In the coastal city of Cartagena, which is known for its colorful colonial architecture, one man is trying to change the historical narrative.
My name is Alex Rocha from Cartagena, Colombia, and I am a tour guide. I do tours that focus on Black culture in Cartagena, Colombia. I do tours that focus on the history of Afro-Colombians.
Today, we join Rocha and 10 travelers from the U.S. on one of his tours in Cartagena. They're walking through the historic center of the city, which is still surrounded by walls built by the Spanish to stop pirates from attacking.
Now, in terms of the slave trade, you know what I mean? Our people will be brought to an area in a plaza where we're going to go later, where they were auctioned. And later, they take into the homes, to the domestic service, or to the fields.
In our tours, we basically show people, first of all, the historic center of Cartagena, which was basically built in the back of the Africans. But at the same time, what's going on with Afro-Colombians today? How our economy, our way of living, our music, you know, and all the different aspects of our culture.
Okay, people, so this is basically the main market of the city. So most of the Afro-Colombian population here in Cartagena will be working here in the informal economy. Try to make a living every day, from 5 a.m. until 7 p.m. every day. Over here, grinding, you know what I mean? Selling the fruits, selling the vegetables, selling the fish.
Now, this is one of the best pineapples you ever tried. It's called Gold and Honey. Come on, get a piece. I am 51 years old, so when I was a teenager, I was immersed into hip-hop music. And that inspired me to learn more about Black American culture, you know, learning about the speeches of Dr. Malcolm X or Dr. Martin Luther King. When I learned about history of Black America, I understood that there was some Black history in Colombia that I wasn't told about.
About the independence of Colombia, you should know that in the 1800s, when the locals started the Revolution of Independence, it was the children of the Spanish born here who wanted to separate from the Spanish system. So they called the Africans to fight for freedom. This is 1811. By 1821, everything ended, the Spanish left, no freedom for the Africans until 1851. You know, so it took 30 years later after it was promised.
The main customers are tourists, basically African-American travelers. You know. 99% of our customers are African-Americans or Black people in general from other part of the world.
And you know, the police, they really give you a hard time. They want to take money from you.
Yeah, yeah.
They relate to what they see here, you know. It's kind of the same experiences that they live back in their homes, back in their countries. So they definitely relate to that, and they, you know, understand it, and they can feel it, you know. It's kind of the same things that happens and they go through in the countries.
Guess who is that over there? That's Christopher Columbus. You know what I mean? That tells you, you know what I mean, that it's still embracing, you know, the colonialism, because the Spanish mentality is still there, you know what I mean? Still a couple of wealth, the power, control everything, you know what I mean?
It is time for people out there, especially minorities, to come together and have a voice so that this society understand that they have caused a lot of damage to these ethnic groups, indigenous people, African people, or Afro-Colombians. And so it's time for people to come together and claim for their rights.
Here is a mural to honor our people. And this is basically honoring Afro-Colombians and indigenous people and those peasants, you know. But at the same time, we honor our folklore, our music, the champeta. You can see the dancing of the champeta. Come on.
We live in a country that for generations have been controlled by the powerful people. So it is hard for, you know, those without the power, you know, to succeed. But, you know, we've seen changes. We are now, as Afro-Colombians, we are more able to express ourselves, to be more visible out there in murals, in graffitis, you know, even through art. Little by little, we're making changes, we're making progress, and we believe and we hope that things get better and better for our people.
That was Alex Rocha, who runs Afro-Colombian History and Culture Tours in Cartagena, Colombia. The story was produced for us by Manuel Rueda. Let's remain in the world of Colombian music as our final note for the day. Decades ago, a Colombian singer named Yuri Buenaventura had moved to Paris to study economics at the Sorbonne. He dropped out to pursue a music career, which faltered until he turned the Edith Piaf classic Ne Me Quitte Pas into a salsa number, and it became a hit. Ne me quitte pas, moi je t'offrirai. That was 1996. Fast forward to today, another younger Colombian in Paris, Pau Barreto, is also making music in the French capital. Pau Barreto has been the frontwoman for several bands that fall under the rubric of French Latin music. We've actually featured her ensemble, the Bongo Hop, on the show. But now Pau Barreto's performing on her own and has released a solo album that brings us a fuller picture of how she approaches music. She sings in Spanish, first of all, and though Barreto has lived in Paris for the past 10 years, she leaves lots of musical footprints back to her home of Colombia, nodding to cumbia rhythms, sounds from the Caribbean, all plugged in electronically. This is her track, Spirales. Music there from Colombia's Pau Barreto. That takes us to the end of our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're online all the time at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with you right here tomorrow. Me están quemando los brazos.